Hello once again to Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. This is the Ethical Concept of Care, Part 2, part of Module 6 in the course, Module 6 being titled The Duty of Care. I'm Stephen Downs, and I'm picking up right where I left off from Part 1, so without further ado, let's go into it. So, where we left off, we were talking about the concept of care rather than being abstract and rather than being deduced from, say, the nature of humanity or whatever. It being, as Carol Gilligan says, an ethic grounded in voice and relationships, in the importance of everyone having a voice, being listened to carefully in their own right and on their own terms, and heard with respect. And additionally, she says, an ethics of care directs our attention to the need for responsiveness in relationships, paying attention, listening, responding, and to the costs of losing connection with oneself or with others. And we see this value expressed a lot. And again, this is a value that existed prior to these theories. And is drawn on because it's a particular way of approaching, you know, ethical issues and other issues in general, from a care perspective. But I remember in 1980, I was on training in Austin, Texas, for Texas Instruments, of all places. And I took a videotaped course all by myself. It wasn't even assigned to me. It was called On the Way Up. And it expressed a number of aspects of how to manage conflict in the work environment. One thing it said is the way you should express yourself is through a process of feel, want, and willing. How does this situation make me feel? What do I want? And what am I willing to do? But it also stressed the relationship aspect of direct communication with the other person. And it taught me about active listening, which I'm sure many of you have heard about, where you don't just sit back and passively let the person speak and then respond. Although that's something that I find myself doing, and I'm sure a lot of other people do, as they sit there listening to the person speak, what they're mostly thinking about is how they'll respond to whatever they're saying, and they're only sort of half listening. And the idea of active listening is that you listen carefully and attentively, and then you offer, in the way of feedback, an attempt to express in your own words what they have told you. And there's a couple of reasons for this, right? First of all, it helps you make sure you get it right. And also it builds trust because the other person is aware that you've actually been listening to them and that you have understood what they've said. And so now when you express what might be your own alternative perspective, they're in a position to at least say, well, okay, I know they've taken what I said into account when they're coming up with this response. And so, you know, it's just a better way of communicating overall. And that's what I thought of first when a number of years later, I encountered Michael Moore's theory of transactional distance, where the whole concept, again, it's, you know, as I learned many years later, it's based on information theory, but the idea is you send out your content or your information, and then they send it back, and you have this process and interaction. So that's a lot of what's happening here. You're making sure that you're in communication with the other person and actually responding. But there's a bit more to it than that, because, you know, as you go through this process of communication, first of all, it's not just a mechanical process. But secondly, it's also based in this idea of building up a relationship with them. So, I mean, I talked about trust. A lot of people go, okay, let's quantify the trust. Let's measure the trust and all of that, building trust. You know, trust in your brand name as being an asset value, etc. That's not quite right either. But this building up a relationship with the other person is an important part of being able to provide care or be cared for by another person. So that's where we begin. Okay. So quite a few contrasts between this view and a more traditional, shall we say, male perspective sort of view can be drawn. Now here, I'm basing this next little bit mostly on the discussion that takes place in this book, Pojman and Pfizer, Discovering Right and Wrong, although I will say, when I got the book specifically for this course, I thought it would have a much more detailed discussion than it has. Oh no, it does not. But it does have a few pages. So, one area of contrast between an ethics of care and more traditional masculine ethics is in the area of identities. And Gilligan says, male identity is based around concepts like personal autonomy, freedom, independence, and privacy, whereas female identity is based more on social network of family, friends, and community. Now, kinda, yeah, but, you know, it's not a male-female kind of thing here in the sense that you're either one or the other, and never the twain shall meet. And I don't think that the sense of building an identity based on these things is exactly what is meant here either. What is it to have an identity even? You could even craft the difference between the two as saying a male identity is built or constructed and a female identity is grown or developed. And so we even have different accounts of what identity is, much less about what those identities consist in. And I think that coming from a feminist perspective, and especially a critical feminist perspective, they would talk about male identities and female identities as being as much socially constructed or socially developed or socially grown, we'll come back to that, as, you know, based in one's genes. And again, it's that nature-nurture thing that we're messing around with. So anyhow, that's one aspect of it. But it does give us a way to distinguish between earlier forms of ethics and later forms of ethics. The earlier ones and the ones that people are talking about most of the time in the domain of ethics and analytics and AI are things like autonomy, freedom, independence, and privacy, all of these quote-unquote male values, and not at all talking about family, friends, and community. In fact, I don't recall, in all the reading that I've done on this subject, I don't recall anyone talking about the impact of AI and analytics on the social network of family, friends, and community. Except maybe Putnam's Bowling Alone and writings of that ilk. But, you know, that's far removed from the immediate subject of ethics and analytics and AI. Another aspect is, and we've mentioned this before, focus on the actual rather than the hypothetical. This is approaching the same issue of abstraction, but from a slightly different direction. And it's worth looking at this direction. Gilligan says that her research is focused on the actual rather than the hypothetical situations of moral conflict and choice. And I've put in here as a diagram, I don't actually provide a reference, but it's to Philippa Foot's famous trolley problem. The trolley problem, again, is not the first time we've talked about it in this course. There you are, you're the person in the middle by the switch. If you pull the switch, you redirect the trolley and kill one person. But if you do nothing, the trolley continues on its way and kills five people. What do you do? What do you do? Well, this is a hypothetical, right? And there's been a lot of discussion of the trolley problem in the literature, and variations on it have been proposed. Like, for example, what if you know the one person? What if the one person is your wife or your husband or your child? What if the one person is Albert Einstein? What if the one person is Adolf Hitler? What if you're choosing between killing an old person or five children? Now, you see all kinds of variations, right? And the point here is that it's the variations that create the problem, not the abstract hypothetical that's been created by Philippa Foot and other philosophers who reason in similar ways. And Gilligan is saying, I was impelled to write about an ethics of care by the disparities that I heard between the voice of moral theories and the voices of people on the ground. Now, that's very much a Harvard way of speaking. The people on the ground. Anyhow. And the logic of an ethics of care is inductive, contextual, and psychological rather than deductive or mathematical. Now, that is kind of a misrepresentation of what the previous theories of ethics are. Nonetheless, you know, you get into the calculations of utility or happiness as measured in hedons, and yeah, okay, you're sort of into deductive and mathematical. But the idea here, the main idea here, is that it's the concrete situation and the opinions of the people in these concrete situations that matter. So let's restate Philippa Foot. What if the person that is going to get hit says, pull the lever, pull the lever? Do you feel the same sort of guilt that you might feel otherwise? And how do the other five people feel about it? Are those five people even aware that the trolley is coming upon them, etc., right? You get into these actual details and the voices of the people. And then all of a sudden, you know, all the things that people talk about when they're talking about the hypothetical version of the problem, all of those hypothetical issues kind of dissipate and go away. And what you're really left with is real trolleys, real people, and a real lever. And all the community around that, and then all the relationships form to make that an actual circumstance, which really can't be described in any sort of abstract way. Another way of saying the same thing, and this happens, right, in this domain, right? We say the same thing, we come at it from different directions. Gilligan, again, and again, I'm drawing from Pojman and Pfizer, expressing the idea that women see morality as based within the context of personal relations as opposed to the male perspective based on making judgments within a rational decision-making framework. But again, it's not an either-or. It's not the idea here that Gilligan is arguing that women see the world this way, and that Gilligan is arguing that this is how we should do moral judgments. It's a bit different from that. I've got a diagram here, and it's a bit hard to read, but I think this is maybe a bit more accurate than what we get in the Postman and Pfizer discussion. Where we begin, not with an assertion, but more of a fact, persons are fundamentally relational, born into conditions of dependence, and care in organizations is primarily located in concrete, enduring emotional relationships. Now, as an aside, there is some discussion in the literature pointing out that they're very rarely concrete and enduring emotional relationships. A lot of these relationships we have, particularly in environments like hospitals, right, they're kind of quick and hopefully kind of brief in a good way. As well, the second part of this is care is a practice as well as a value, with special importance accorded to dialogical practice. So, and that's what we mean by saying morality is based within the context of personal relations, right? It's actually not a thing about making judgments, not in the sense that we think of making judgments within this rational decision-making framework. It's a practice in, you know, let me put it into male terms, right? It's a practice like being a mechanic is a practice, right? Being a mechanic is about having grease on your hands, getting them in the car, working with them, shaking that piece, nudging that piece, getting a sense of what's wrong and what's right with the car, and then doing the thing that needs doing, not as a decision, but because it's the thing that needs doing. See the difference? Right? You know, nobody would approach mechanics from the perspective of you need to approach a car with a car theory, and the car theory will inform how you need to fix that problem. Now, you could. You can come up with a car theory. You can come up with a mechanic decision-making framework for cars, and people have. I've seen them, right? And you can even have the mechanic remember that framework. But when they're actually doing the repair, they're not depending on the framework. The framework might be informative and helpful, but it's not like they're making judgments based on the framework. They're finding what needs to be done by interacting with the thing and then doing what needs to be done because that's the thing that needs to be done. And as you've guessed by my tone, perhaps, it's not particularly a woman thing. What makes it something that is a kind of morality that women see as opposed to men is the relationship here that I've just sketched is between a man and an object. Whereas what Gilligan is talking about for the most part are relations between one person and another person. And the other person isn't the car. And you can't just jiggle it to see how it's working. And the kind of interaction you have is more relational and more dependent on intangibles like trust and respect and care. So we get to the, you know, the relations versus judgments bit. An ethics of care conceives of truth as local and evaluated in terms of its effects. It's not, did I follow the right procedure to fix the car? It is, did the car work? Care implies vulnerability and struggle rooted in social and political conditions. Now, that's the part about human to human. We're going to come back to that. And then an ethic of care values the growth of the cared for and accepts an uncertain future. And again, we're going to come back to that, the whole concept of empowerment. And I've seen this in a few cases, reading about care, in cases where the writers were male, and especially analytical, that's spam, so I'm just going to screen it. There we go. If I was a professional, I would have had my calls blocked before I started doing this, but, yeah, well. I think I pretty much covered that slide. I was right in the middle of a sentence. I don't know how it ended. This diagram is from Thomas B. Lawrence and Sally Maitlis. The article is Care and Possibility, Enacting an Ethic of Care Through Narrative Process. And you can have a look at it right there. And I mention that because it's not on the PowerPoint slide, the title and that. The link is there, and the link works. I do notice men writing about the ethics of care from this rational decision-making framework perspective. And it's kind of the thing that makes me think of George Lakoff and frames, right? And it's almost like they're unable to escape the frame of traditional ethics when talking about the ethics of care. And it's a challenge. It's totally a challenge, and I totally get that because I are one. All right. I said I'd talk about the role of dependence, and that's one of these things that's really important in the ethics of care. And Gilligan writes about the female view of morality being based on vulnerability and dependence, with the male orientation emphasizing rational, courageous, and fully informed people. And that's these guys again. But it's interesting reading Sarah Clark Miller on this and talking about the way dependence can be inversed and the way the ethics of care inverts dependence. And she raises specifically, this photo is from her article, raises the case of Wonder Woman being brought forward as an example of power and being in control and being the solution and not being vulnerable and dependent. And that, of course, made me to think of the very short tenure of Wonder Woman, quote unquote, because it wouldn't be the original Wonder Woman pictured here, I don't think. As the UN ambassador for empowering girls and women. And it sort of points to the two sides of this, right? Because we look at Wonder Woman here, especially this version, but even the new version. And mostly, I think, we see the costume rather than the empowerment and the Amazonian roots and the taking charge of situations, etc. And that's kind of, it's kind of like a type of dependency, even a type of oppression you can't really get out of. And it's reasonably well discussed, I think, by Miller. The ethics of care, I probably should have inverted these two slides, but that's okay. The ethics of care and the ethics of right, the female and the male perspective can be contrasted. And here this is contrasted in Braybeck, and actually quoted by Desiat Harihani. The ethics of care is achieved through perception of oneself as connected to others versus the ethics of rights achieved through process of separation and individuation of self from others. In care, moral dilemmas are textual. In rights theory, moral dilemmas are universal. in care, they're solved through inductive thinking. In rights, they're solved through an application of abstract or formal thinking, etc. You get the idea, right? And that's what makes the whole Wonder Woman thing sort of interesting, because what's happening here is that you're taking a female figure and basically putting her into the rights perspective. So she's accomplishing the empowerment of women and girls, first of all, by dressing up in the costume, but then by looking at these moral dilemmas from this universal perspective, from being representative of right, of good, of order, of structure, and appealing to universal principles and applying them to moral dilemmas in a universal way, like all superheroes. And in fact, that's the whole concept of being a superhero. Although, aside, the more interesting superhero stories are stories where that concept breaks down. A lot of the time it doesn't break down and they just resolve it by fighting, and then whoever has the more moral right on their side wins, because that's the way it always works. But sometimes, and especially in some of the earlier Spider-Man stuff, it does break down, and it breaks down in interesting ways. End of aside. Because, of course, I'd have a commentary about superhero comics. Who do you think I am? So the Wonder Woman case is interesting, and it is illustrative of a dilemma faced, I think, by the feminist movement in general, and by ethics of care in particular. And it talks to the sort of oppression that they have to work against. So the focus then for the ethics of care is on the cared for. And that's a term, I think it's from Noddings. Right, so you have the caregiver and the cared for. I also use the term carer, and so does she. I'm not really, there is a distinction between the idea of being a caregiver and a carer, but that's we don't need to go into that kind of detail here, because we're going into enough as it is, right? So the idea here is, and Noddings says, instead of turning to a principle for guidance, a carer turns to the cared for. What does he or she need? Will filling this need harm others in the network of care? Am I competent to fill this need? Will I sacrifice too much of myself? Is the expressed need really in the best interest of the cared for? And here we see all of these considerations that we've talked about from some of the previous slides come up to the fore. The question of stealing bread, right? Imagine asking me all these questions when you're considering whether or not to steal bread. Imagine asking all of these questions when considering whether or not to pull the lever on the trolley. But you know, it doesn't come up in those abstract formulations because there isn't a real person and there isn't a real situation. Jean Valjean is a fictional character and has no dimension or no community beyond what we see on the screen or in the play, as it were. And we can't, for example, distinguish in these hypotheticals between a felt need, something that I would perceive from a situation, and an expressed need, what some person in the situation would actually say to me. And it's hard to draw the distinction between a normative approach, which would be how I approach the ethical issue based on my best professional judgment, versus comparative assessments based on needs of people, here it says with similar attributes, but with similar attributes that are based on the needs of actual people. And that's a characterization of Bradshaw's typology of needs, right? And this typology is important here in this context because it's describing or helping us describe the difference between an actual concrete situation and an abstract situation. And the concrete and the abstract are going to differ in all four of those types of expressions of needs. And that's why the abstract, you can't just take what you would do in the abstract and apply it to the concrete. Or as I like to say, you've got to get grease on your hands. You just have to. Or, you know, sometimes I talk, you know, from my experience as a journalist, you know, and, you know, journalists, real journalists say, you know, like, I've got ink stain on my hand, right? I've actually been involved in the process of producing a newspaper. And that's different from thinking about it hypothetically, as in a Lou Grant or the newsroom or whatever. Totally, they're totally different situations. What was that Aaron Sorkin show about the news? I watched that, and I was sort of like, you know, nobody is going to preface their arguments in the newsroom with, well, I love my country as much as anyone, but, well, it's real-world conversations aren't like that. And that's why that series failed. Another aspect here is thinking of the cared for as empowered, right? It's not simply that they have a say. It's not simply that they have a voice. It's that they are the ones making the decisions about their own care. And I'm quoting Karen Costa here, and I think this is Karen Ray Costa, but I'm not positive, and I couldn't find the actual sort of the source of the quote, but I did link to some of her resources on this. But the concept here is sound in that the ethics of care isn't just about giving people a voice. It isn't just about having conversations or having relationships with them. It's that they actually make decisions about their own care. And that's a fundamental principle of healthcare. And indeed, it's a fundamental principle of care ethics and I think a lot of ethics in general. I see it a lot. Well, we saw it in ethical codes. And we see it a lot in the discussions that we have on research ethics boards, where, you know, it's up to the people whose data is collected how that data is used, etc. So there is that sense of empowerment. A lot of the time, it's how that is manifest, how it's represented. But the key thing here is this isn't consultation in the sense of consultation, where we have a conversation, you tell me what you think, and then I go ahead and implement whatever solution I was going to anyways. We do that a lot in politics and in business and in industry and in organizations generally. Trust me, I've seen it a dozen times per week. But in ethics of care, that doesn't actually happen. And it's a big part of my own theory of learning that the learner decides what and how to learn. And there's a lot of talk, even talk about pedagogies of care, but also talk about personalized learning and learning in general, where we will consult the learner or maybe create a contract with the learner, but ultimately ends up with whoever's in charge making the decisions about what will be learned and how it will be learned And then they can make some choices sort of on the margins, you know, like what kind of color is your background, or are you going to have a serif or non-serif font on your screen, or will you do your work on Friday or on Saturday? Trivial things. But there's a process here, and we've got six principles of trauma-informed care from the CDC in the United States, beginning with safety, having the person in a safe environment, establishing trustworthiness and transparency, and that's some of this active listening that I talked about, peer support, which I haven't talked about, collaboration and mutuality, which I haven't talked about, and then empowerment, which is both voice and choice, and then the consideration of cultural, historical, and gender issues. Now, I'd probably put that a little earlier in the process, but I mean, but then again, it's not a process, right? Take all of these six things, pile them up on top of each other, and you've probably got something that resembles more an ethics of care. Another way in which care ethics differs from traditional ethics and indeed traditional thought is with the concept of objectivity. And that's also something I ran into a lot in journalism. It's something that we run into a lot in education. And it's kind of interesting. Dave Cormier just did a tweet on a blast from the past of myself and George Siemens talking about whether there is an objective truth about the world. Objectivity is this value, and again, it's, you know, depicted as this male or masculine value, where you know, you stand apart from whatever it is that you're talking about. You know, the classic example is objectivity in news reporting, where you don't take sides, right? But there's also the idea of objectivity in science. You go where the data leads you. In education, we hear talk about evidence-informed or evidence-based decision-making. And again, that's appealing to this principle of objectivity. Bell Hooks, writing about this, makes an observation that strikes me as dead on. She writes, "The professors who prided themselves on their capacity to be objective were most often those who were directly affirmed in their caste, class, or status position." And that's the thing with objectivity, right? Objectivity, or being neutral, is, in a very important sense, a reification of the status quo. It's taking the way things are now as normal. So, Parker Palmer, I'll quote here, "The oppression of cultural minorities by a white middle-class male version of truth comes in part from the domineering mentality of objectivism. Once the objectivism has the facts, no listening is required. No other points of view are needed. The facts, after all, are the facts. All that remains is to bring others into conformity with objective truth." You see the danger of this, right? You can see that, you know, and I'm just thinking, you know, I'm thinking as I read that about the example I just gave about the mechanic, right? And, you know, it's not an opinion. You're not making a judgment about how to repair something. It just is the way it is, right? Think of that in contrast with this. It sounds like I'm saying the same thing, but I really think I'm saying two different things. The facts, as expressed by objectivity, are just as much data-laden and subjective as the fact of what's happening when the mechanic plays with the car. They both represent a point of view. They both represent a certain way of having hands on a situation. But one of them depicts itself as though it were neutral, independent from a, you know, a third-party stance looking down on a situation. But of course, that stance, that perspective, is almost always the perspective of people who are in the highest class or caste, who are in positions of privilege, who are able to look down with the leisure and the freedom and the resources to create this objective third-person point of view. And we used to have a lot of discussions about this in Canadian University Press in the 1980s when I was active in that organization about just what did it mean for journalists to say, we are objective. And, you know, we had a lot of disputes, but among the student journalists in Canada at that time, it was generally agreed that being objective was to reinforce the existing power structure in society. That was, quote unquote, the neutral stance. And the question that we wrestled with was not whether that was true, but how best to, I'm looking for a word here, respond to that, how best to work with that, perhaps even how best to oppose that. And Canadian University Press at the time was divided between being an agent of social change, as one group of people said, probably representing what might today be called the feminist point of view. Certainly all the feminists were on that side. And then the other point of view, which frankly I was on as well, being agents of social awareness, and the perhaps naive belief that if you made people aware of things like normal means power structures as usual, that they could make their own decision. But you see the difference, you see some of the debate here though, right? Because how can people make their own decisions, decide for themselves, if you, as the caregiver, are determined to create change in them or for them of a certain sort? That's why I've always felt that's why I felt then that my relationship with the reader was a better relationship when it was more like this conversation back and forth, where I made them aware, here's the world as I've seen it, but they make their own decisions, as opposed to me being the agent that creates change in the reader. It's a pretty fine distinction, I think, but it's the sort of considerations that come up in an ethics of care that I don't think really come up in any of the ethical perspectives, certainly not to the depth that we've discussed them in this course. The other side of caring is the carer, or the one caring, or as I've also characterized it, as the caregiver. This is interesting. Bell Hooks again saying, sorry about the capitalization there, that's auto-capitalized by PowerPoint. Feminist politics is still the only movement for social justice that offers a vision of mutual well-being as a consequence of its theory and practice. That might be overstating it. I think that John Rawls would probably say, well, I think mutual well-being is a consequence of justice as fairness. But there is a bit of a difference in the sense that, justice as fairness isn't really concerned about well-being in any practical, concrete sense. And, if people think it's all fair, then some people might still be hurt, some people might still starve. As is usual in ethical theories based on calculation. But again, and this is interesting. I mentioned earlier the way male writers sometimes talk about caring. I quoted from Britannica here and deliberately brought out and named the authors because one of them's named Craig and the other's named Brian. And they write, "What is distinctive in all such relations is that the one caring acts in response to a perceived need on the part of the cared for. Caring thus involves sentiment, but is not necessarily emotional in nature." Just think about that, and we'll do a little bit of critical pedagogy here. First of all, they got it wrong. It's not in response to a perceived need. It can be perceived, but mostly it's in response to an expressed need, as we mentioned earlier. But also, it involves sentiment, but is not necessarily emotional in nature. I think that you would find it generally is emotional in nature, although we need to talk about what that cashes out to be. But there's also a sense here that they're saying that it would be bad if it was emotional in nature. And they're also looking at the word sentiment as kind of a technical term. And to cash that out a bit, I've got a diagram here that talks about the different kinds of sentiments, ranging from amusement, excitement, joy, love, desire, optimism, etc., including remorse, sadness, grief, disgust, anger. All of those are sentiments, right? But all of those are emotions as well. But the idea of sentiment is that it's a feeling. It's like a sensation. The idea of emotion is that there's a value attached to it. And the diagram there, it actually has positive, negative, and ambiguous sentiments. The ambiguous ones, in case you're curious, are realization, surprise, curiosity, and confusion, which I don't think are really that ambiguous, but nonetheless. And now, in the discussion of care and care ethics, I think that emotion plays an important role. And we talk about, or they talk about, the feeling of the need to care as being a motivating factor, that you have to have this motivation. That's what creates a duty, right? It's not simple, it's not an inclination to care. Right, it's a duty to care, and this duty comes not from some external imposed force or some universal principle. It comes from the weight that the need to care bears on you right now, and it wouldn't work if it wasn't emotional in nature. Unless you have that force of feeling in yourself, you don't create a duty. So I think Dunn and Burton are wrong on both counts there. But they're not wrong in the sense that, they're just making objective mistakes. They're wrong in the sense that they're looking at an ethical theory from the perspective of ethical theories, properly so-called, rather than looking at the ethics of care from within the context of ethics of care, which is what I'm trying to do here. Probably also failing in my own way. I admit that. But nonetheless, I'm trying to draw that distinction. Okay. Caregiving. Let me just read this and then we'll go into the discussion. "By claiming that women utilize an ethic of care while men use justice," and again, there's that distinction again, "Gilligan seems to suggest that women are better suited for caregiving roles within the home than for professional life." And that's Jean Keller writing in 25 Years of Care Ethics. But this reflects, she continues, "the many ways women's caregiving work has been marginalized and devalued." "The many ways women's caregiving work has been marginalized and devalued is radical, transformative, and vitally important feminist work." So the idea here is pointing out, and this is This is the purpose of drawing the distinction between the male and the female approach, right? It's not to draw a distinction between a male and female approach. Right? That's what a male philosopher would do. That's what I would do, right? But it's to highlight this aspect of women's experience, women's traditional experience, and to draw out and make the case and show that this work has been marginalized and devalued. And that's why we have this distinction between a male approach and a female approach. The female approach consists of approaches that have been marginalized and devalued. Why? Because they are approaches that come from women, right? And because of the way society was structured, the approach that comes from women is devalued and marginalized. So showing how this happens, says Keller, is transformative and vitally important feminist philosophical work. And the reason why it's important, this is me speaking now, is not simply to push back against the marginalization and devaluation of women, although that's part of it, and an important part of it, but to also suggest that this work, the caregiving work, and the thinking behind it, should also not be marginalized and devalued. That the thinking behind caregiving is as important to defining ethics, among other things, as things like rationality, abstract principle calculation, and the rest. Again, it's not a battle between the two, although you often see it represented that way. It's a reclamation of one from the position of being devalued back to thinking of it as something valuable and the people who practice it as we suggested earlier, as persons. If we think about it, and we look at the historical role women have played in thought, if I had to give it an overall characterization, which I did at the top there, I'd say women have typically been treated as, quote, the other in philosophical thought, and generally because philosophical thought has generally been written by men. So you would expect that woman would be thought of as the other. But, you know, it's not just a neutral other. Aristotle, by natural design, women are the followers. Rousseau, progressive in so many ways. Women are weak, passive, offer little resistance. Nietzsche, and we could talk lots about Nietzsche and women, but I won't because it's a different subject. But the most neutral, the most neutral thing I can say about Nietzsche is women are deep, deceptive, like truth, might be his impression of women. I think he values them, but is afraid of them at the same time, which is a typical male response. Mary Wollstonecraft draws out, and I think this is important, the distinction between whether the way women think and women's ways in the world are based on instinct, in other words, nature, or social construction. And it says, you know, at one point, women or girls wouldn't be so interested in dolls if they weren't forced to be interested in dolls by their confinement. That's a paraphrase, but you get the idea. And Sarah Clark Miller draws out an interesting thing, talking about the public-private divide, the idea that historically women were the people at home, that they expressed their influence in private to a man, of course, and they weren't expected to participate in public life. But one of the major impacts of the feminist movement of the 60s, 70s, and 80s and beyond was that women came out into the public and manifested their thoughts, beliefs, and ways of doing things in a much more public way. And of course, there's a constant effort by at least certain segments of society to put them back into that private role. We see this explicitly in countries like Afghanistan, but we see it implicitly, I think, in many other ways, and I won't go through it. I think we'll just observe that that's the case. So, there are feminist roots to the ethics of care, and I think, you know, we would be completely misrepresenting it if we didn't say that. Here's the two male authors in Britannica describing this again. They write, quote, "It so happens that those writing in the feminine tradition have come to associate care and responsibility to others with a female-gendered approach to ethics and individual rights and justice with a male-gendered approach to ethics. Feminist philosophers have argued that the deontological, utilitarian, and justice moral theories are grounded in the masculine experience." When they say justice moral theories, I think they mean social contract theories or Rawlsian theory of justice, perhaps. It's not clear exactly what their perspective is. To a degree, that's true. But I don't think it's nearly as passive as they represent here. You know, it so happens that, you know, I mean, it could have been any other way, but it just happened. I don't think that's it at all. I think there are very good reasons why those writing in the feminine tradition have come to associate care and responsibility in ethics. And I think the ethics of care explores this and makes it very explicit. We'll talk about that in a bit when we talk about, for example, oppression. Noddings, I think, has a better take on it. I forget exactly where she wrote this, but I know she wrote this. "From the perspective of the patriarchy, the ethics of care is a feminist philosophy, but from a wider perspective, it's a humanist philosophy." And that, too, is the thing that I would agree with as well. Part of the problem, too, is that there's feminism and there's feminism. And we talked earlier about the Wonder Woman thing, right? Wonder Woman promoting the value of girls and women by taking over the male role. And that's what might be called traditional feminism. Where feminism is, quote, freedom from sex-determined roles, as compared to the current kind of feminism that we're talking about, here quoting bell hooks, feminism defined in political terms that stress collective as well as individual experience. Hooks makes the point, and for some very good reasons, that you don't get to have, if you will, to use a phrase, the best of both worlds here, right? You don't get to be a feminist and still agree with these quote-unquote masculine values. We resist, she writes, the emphasis on individual identity and lifestyle. Terms like liberal feminist and bourgeois feminist represent contradictions. And I don't think that's literally true, because there is that other branch of feminism, right? And it exists and is therefore not really a contradiction, because contradictions don't exist. But thinking of feminism in the current context, the current context being the discussion of the ethics of care, the feminism that results in an ethics of care would produce a contradiction. So terms like liberal ethics of care theory or bourgeois ethics of care theory, those we could say represent contradictions. And it's important to understand why that's the case. Gender, I mean, the ethics of care comes from origins in gender inequality. The fact of gender inequality and the historical gender equality and the different views that we've already sketched out of gender inequality themselves are directly related to the characterization of an ethics of care as it has been characterized. Now, let's draw back a little bit and talk about what we mean by equity and inequity, right? Or equity or equality and inequality. And I know there's a difference between these two words, but we'll gloss that just for the moment. So here's Goren Thurborn. We conceptualize gender inequality as a complex and intersectional issue, which is related to at least three dimensions of inequality: vital inequality, resource inequality, and existential inequality. Now, resource inequality is pretty much self-explanatory, right? It's access to resource. Vital inequality is equality with respect to things that, like health and fitness and life and those sorts of things, and would include things like control over your own body, etc. Existential inequality here means denial of, I put in brackets, equal recognition and respect, and is a potent generator of humiliations for Black people, Amer Indians, women in patriarchal societies, poor immigrants, low castes, stigmatized ethnic groups. Now again, sort of like an American-ish perspective, but bringing in castes, so you know, it's not just American, but you know, when we're talking about Amer Indians, you know, there's Canadian Indians, there's South American Indians, there's the Aborigines of Australia, there are indigenous people in Africa. So, let's think of this more globally. But the point here is that there is a fact of gender inequality. It's related to other forms of inequality. If we consider all of these together, that's what we call intersectional. So the types of inequality intersect, right? It's one thing to be, it's one thing to be sitting here listening to a train. It's one thing to be oppressed as a woman. It's another thing to be oppressed as a Black woman. Or as I suggested at the top, the very beginning of these presentations, it's one thing to be a woman who is oppressed. It's another to be a woman who's a Harvard professor who's oppressed. There's differences here. And that's what this gets at. So nobody has a monopoly on oppression. And the intersectional perspective recognizes, I think, that each person's experience of oppression is personal and deeply personal and felt differently by every person because they're in a different circumstance, in a different situation. Okay. Inequality, there's different ways you can produce inequality. Thurborn lists four. Again, this is an exercise in categorization. So we can just take it as, you know, a survey of the field rather than, you know, describing an objective reality. But the four ways are distanciation, This is the idea about people falling behind or people running ahead. Exclusion, which is what apartheid was, right? Barriers erected to make it impossible for certain categories of people to access a good life. Redlining is another example of that. Hierarchy, the whole idea of societies and organizations constituted as ladders, some people perched on top and other people below. And this, you think about the whole concept of class mobility and that kind of dialogue, right? That is a dialogue that assumes inequality exists and is the norm, and that will continue, but it's okay if you allow people to move between the different levels. And then exploitation, which is a predominant form of inequality in global society today, in which the riches of the rich derive from the toil and the subjection of the poor and disadvantaged. And you don't need to go very far to see examples of that. Probably the shirt that I'm wearing is an example of that. Sorry, Creative Commons, but I bet you it's true. And I'm not happy about it, but they don't make shirts in Canada anymore. My grandfather used to make shirts, but not anymore. So what we have in feminist theory is a response to this oppression. And there's a couple aspects here, and again, Sarah Clark Miller draws this out. And this is why it's hard to get at something like an ethics of care. So, we live in a world in which gender oppression is so pervasive and so normalized that often we do not even perceive the patterns of subordination surrounding us. And that's kind of like the Wonder Woman thing, right? It didn't even occur to the people at the UN that, you know, the clothing Wonder Woman wore signified her as someone who's oppressed, even at the same time you're presenting her as a beacon of breaking free from oppression, a beacon of power and liberty. Because for all of what she does, she still has to appeal to young male eyes. And this is what Marilyn Fry calls the double bind, right? Or another way of putting it is, you should smile more, right? To smile on command is to participate in one's own oppression. Not to smile, however, places one at risk of being on the receiving end of censure, anger, or even outright violence. Plenty of examples of that. And it's not just women, right? We look at the case, and I forget all the names that are involved in it, but it was just a recently concluded court case in the United States where a black man was jogging through what is normally perceived to be a white neighborhood. He was chased down by some armed man who cornered him and demanded that he answer their questions, which he refused to do, so they shot him. Right. Now, the logic is, you really should answer the questions, right? But if you think about that, right, saying, yes, I should answer your questions, because here you are, you've got me. Right. That's just to participate in your own oppression. That's to accept that these white men have the right to track him down and force him to answer questions just because he's a black man jogging in a white neighborhood. And that's wrong. But that's the dilemma that this person faced. And he refused, and now he's dead. And that is oppression. And that's the kind of oppression that oppressed people generally face, where they need to be ruling participants in their own oppression. And that's why an ethics of care has to be about more than just caring for the oppressed. It has to be allowing and indeed enabling the oppressed to, if you will, not smile, right? It's to make it legitimate for them to respond to their oppression in ways that are uncomfortable to the oppressor. On TikTok, there's a guy, I don't know his name, but he'll be recognizable to anybody who's on TikTok. He begins his comments with, "Hey, colonizer." Naturally, a lot of people objected to that. He's a First Nations or an Indigenous man. I don't know where he lives or what country he's from. There's a bunch of really good Indigenous people on TikTok who help me a lot, actually, even though they don't know me from Adam. But he explained at one point that, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, if that, the whole idea here is that being able to express himself in a way that whites or colonizers find disturbing is exactly the point, because it draws out in these people the instinct that they should be able to say, "Hey, you, stop that." And he would just have to stop that. But of course, he doesn't have to stop that. That's one of the things about the internet, too, and in social media generally, is that we don't have the power to oppress people the way we used to, although that might be coming back. So, almost done this bit, and then we'll end this particular bit of the presentation. In fact, no, I'm going to end it right there. This is where I wanted to end. Just my numbering was a little off. So, as you saw briefly on the next slide, out of this will arise a duty to act, right? The duty to act comes from the recognition of oppression, right? The idea that there is such a duty, that this ethical duty of care exists at all. Maybe in part it comes from this traditional idea of female values of caring or female roles of caring. But I think that an equally important source, if not the most important source, is the lived history of women as being oppressed. And the people that are writing today are women that in their younger years were oppressed. A lot of the freedoms that women have today are actually quite recent, and people can remember, it's within living memory that women couldn't own property. In many places, women couldn't vote. We're still having stories in the news about the first woman this and the first woman that. It's recent. And the experience of rising from this oppression and what it's like to be oppressed and then to be working with people who are in positions of vulnerability because they have been oppressed or simply because they're vulnerable leads to an ethics of care. Because you can justify and rationalize till the sun comes home, till the cows come home or the sun goes down, and show that, yes, indeed, different roles for the sexes or the genders just make sense. Or you can say, based on our natural understanding of the world, everybody is either a man or a woman, and never the twain shall meet, etc. All of these abstract theories can be used to justify oppression. But if you're working against oppression, or if you are among those seeking to be, in the future, no longer oppressed, then these generalizations don't help much. They do more harm than good. And what really matters is the real lived experience of the people who are vulnerable, who are being oppressed. So I think it's a natural that the ethics of care is a feminist ethic. And if you had to ask me, which you probably don't, but I wouldn't trace it to a naturalist theory of what women are like. And I wouldn't even trace it to a historical account of what women's roles are. I would trace it to the very real experience of emerging from oppression, or in the words of Booker T. Washington, up from slavery. I'm Stephen Downs. Part 3 is coming. We got a lot more to talk about on this subject, and as you can see, I'm getting into it. So, talk to you soon. Nothing like a good male burp at the end of that.